Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Here we go. Senator Erica Betts makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was last here as a senior minister in the Howard government. So I'll introduce him very briefly. Senator Betts is leader of the opposition in the Senate and the shadow minister for employment and workplace relations, and his topic tonight is green light for Senate chaos. Senator Betts, you're welcome.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and if I may commence with an apology. I was a bit like a country boy lost in a big city, and the driver also confronted substantial delays in the traffic. So for the inconvenience, please accept my sincere apologies. As of the 1st of July, Australians will be relying on the House of Representatives to block the excesses of the Senate. Who would ever have thought? I'm sure our founding fathers never envisaged such an outcome. Nevertheless, it's a good reminder how a bicameral system provides vital safeguards. With a Labor-Green alliance running the Senate, it will fall to the House of Representatives, and in particular, the four independents, to determine our fate. It is a worrying time for our nation and for our federation. The uncertainty alone will impact on our economy if the Tasmanian experience is any guide. That is why it is opportune to have an occasion such as this, kindly provided by the Sydney Institute, to expose, examine and explore the ramifications. On the 1st of September 2010, Australians witnessed the spectacle of Ms Gillard and Senator Brown seated at a table, signing a document with wattle sprigs in their lapels and an adoring bridal party behind them witnessing the occasion. The scene was suggestive of a civil marriage, albeit one of convenience. The published photograph of the event did hold my fascination. On studying it, I could not help but note its orchestration. The bowed heads, the folded hands of the witnesses, some smirking, but also the wary faces of the leaders, and the uncertainty suggested by the large doors behind, as if everyone could somehow go back inside and have another configuration emerge. I believe that picture tells us a lot about the alliance, and for this reason, it has been so commented on and reproduced. But away from the photo, the deal itself has implications for our nation that are extremely worrying. So tonight, I want to pose two questions. With whom are we dealing, and with what are we dealing? Hailing from Tasmania and having served in the Senate for slightly longer than Senator Brown, I have been in an unique position to observe the Greens and their leader for over three decades. Until now, their 15-second grabs, extreme policies and personal hypocrisies have been treated at best with indifference or at worst with gushing endorsement. Here are a few examples which together build a picture of the Greens. Whilst in themselves, individually, they may be overlooked, together they paint a picture of inconsistent behaviour and a misplaced sense of moral superiority. Here are some that I have recalled. It seems gagging parliamentary debates is to be condemned as a fundamental abrogation of the parliamentary process. That is, unless the Greens want to gag the coalition. Missing votes in the Senate is indicative of a party that is a rabble and a matter deserving media exposure. That is, unless it is the Greens leader who misses a vote. Bad behaviour and verbal insults in the Parliament are to be condemned, unless they are in furtherance of a justifiable Green cause. All parliamentarians should be transparent and accountable. That is, unless you want to receive donations to a personal bank account, then file late returns and identify many donors as simply anonymous in furtherance of the cause, you understand. Receiving large donations taints political parties. That is, unless you are the beneficiary. Receiving donations from a particular source with an agenda prejudices a party's policy making. That is, unless you receive even larger donations from the CFMEU. Senators even need to have a dress code determined by the Senate. That is, unless you lose the motion and ignore the will of the Senate anyway. The use of timber for energy and biomass should be condemned. That is, unless you want a log fire for personal use. And the one that I did like, championing National Go Home on Time Day, is such an important principle that it demands a motion in the Senate. Unless, on that very same day, your party moves an extension of Senate sitting hours to try to ram something through. These are just a smattering of the inconsistencies. Mine are in themselves granted, but very illuminating in that their frequency establishes a pattern of behaviour. Any other party and its leaders would have been hounded for such an array of double standards, as they should have been. But not so the Greens. That is, until very recently. I am gratified that the Greens are at last being given the scrutiny they deserve. For too long, the Greens have flown under the radar. Until now, simplistic and extremist policies and double standards have been overshadowed by the Greens' image of being well-meaning tree huggers. The new paradigm of scrutiny appears to have come as a shock to the Greens. First, we had Senator Brown labelling News Limited the hate media. Next was the disclosure that he repeatedly complained to ABC Managing Director Mark Scott about the ABC's 2010 coverage, something I found astounding, given that only 5 of the 982 complaints about the ABC's election coverage related to anti-Green bias, and those 5 had to do with inadequate coverage. Most recently, Senator Brown threateningly declared that he will take on the media which has, to quote him, crossed the line. The truth is that the Greens have crossed the line from the political margin into the mainstream, and after 30 years of largely uncritical media coverage, they are finding it difficult to adjust to the scrutiny some of us have had to put up with from day one. The illusion we are dealing with a benign group of people, naive in the ways of the world, needs to be debunked, and the quicker the better. No, the Greens are not a group of benign environmentalists, nor are koalas, threatened species and habitat top of their agenda. That is their cuddly facade. Too many of the organisers and activists within the Greens are simply unreconstructed old guard lefties. That is why the description watermelons is still so apt. A green layer covering a substantial red core. From your local senator-elect Lee Rhiannon or the member for Melbourne, Adam Bandt, the Greens stand for uncompromising, old-style left-wing politics. The father of the Senate, Senator Ron Boswell, recently provided this following perceptive insight. Australia needs to work out very quickly that the Greens are the one nation of the left. Bob Brown is the socialist Pauline Hanson. The big and alarming difference between them lies in the public's perception. The danger represented by the extreme right position of Hanson and One Nation was clear from the very beginning. The flip side, the left-wing extremism of the Greens, is still largely under the radar. The Greens are still far too widely perceived as a benign political force. End of quote. Indeed, in Senator Hanson Young's intolerance of controls on illegal immigration, we see the flip side of her namesake's view that both people should be turned away. Senator-elect Lee Rhiannon is the epitome of the Red-Green, an uncompromising inner-city left-wing activist who, as a member of the Socialist Party of Australia, towed the Moscow line after the 1968 invasion of Czechoslovakia. It is said the communists are the dominant faction in the New South Wales Greens. Adam Bandt is a former industrial lawyer and partner at Slater and Gordon, who, as a student communist at Murdoch University, opined that the only way to influence the government's agenda was to support the Greens. One should note, as an aside, that Ms. Gillard came to politics via the Socialist Forum and Slater and Gordon, not a dissimilar political pedigree to Adam Bandt. But today, it is no longer just conservatives labelling the Greens extremists. Ms. Gillard has found it politically necessary to do so as well. 6 months into their relationship, she is claiming that, and I quote, "The Greens will never embrace Labor's delight at sharing the values of everyday Australians in our cities, suburbs, towns and bush, who day after day do the right thing, leading purposeful and dignified lives, driven by love of family and nation." End of quote. My colleague, Senator Barnaby Joyce, hit the nail on the head when he said, "It's like walking down the street, holding your lover's hand and yelling out, 'This relationship is a farce.'" Be that as it may, the Greens-Labor agreement is clearly already shaky. It was driven from the Labor side by the fact that after the 1st of July 2011, the Greens will hold the balance of power in the Senate. And from the Greens side by the knowledge that the Labor Party was their best vehicle for implementing their left-wing agenda. From the 1st of July, the numbers in the Senate will be 34 Coalition, 31 Labor, 9 Greens, 1 DLP after an absence of 36 years, and Senator Xenophon, giving Labor and the Greens a majority of 40 out of 76 seats, and giving the Greens a veto over any Labor legislation opposed by the Coalition. Given this power, the Greens do need to be held to account. Prior inconsistent statements need to be probed. Their policy program needs to be understood. So, with what are we dealing? The three areas Ms. Gillard nominated as priorities in her first week as Prime Minister, illegal immigration, the mining tax and climate change, are still a mess. Her Citizens Assembly and East Timor Processing Centre were simply chimeras. By October 2010, a McKay report found that many people surveyed felt Ms. Gillard stood for nothing or very little other than holding on to power. New heights of acuity were reached when she outlined her three-year, five-point plan to a special end-of-year caucus meeting. Her plan? A stronger economy, a more sustainable environment, a fairer society, governing for all Australians, and keeping Australians safe at home and strong in the world. All motherhood statements absolutely confirming that her government was bereft of any agenda. Now, they tell me that vacuums aren't a natural state. They tend to get filled, especially in politics. The Greens have observed this and are busily filling the agenda vacuum with their own. The first product of the Greens-Labor agreement was the breaking of the vow made to the Australian people in full prospect of a hung parliament that there would be no carbon tax under a government led by Ms. Gillard. And recall the media conference at the announcement. no treasurer, despite it being sold as a vital economic reform. There were two Labor, two Greens and two Independents, all three groupings represented as equal partners. And who dominated the conference? It was the Greens. They were telling us how they got this policy position. And of course there have been other policy positions, such as to introduce a progressive flood levy, to reignite the debate on gay marriage, to have a week-long debate on Afghanistan, to give the territories the right to make their own laws on gay unions and euthanasia, to means test the private health insurance rebate, to quietly dissolve the Work for the Dole scheme, to restore $100 million in funding for solar and rental assistance schemes, to restrict the FBT concessions on company cars, to apply $20 million to an implementation study of a high-speed rail network, and to pursue independent contractors. Now, the recent budget exemplified Labor's paralysis. Despite claiming its budget was tough, departmental officials confirmed to me at Senate estimates that the government was saving less than half a cent in every dollar over the forward estimates. And meanwhile, the government has surreptitiously introduced legislation to raise the debt ceiling from $200 to $250 billion. And despite Labor dancing to the Greens' tune, Bob Brown had the chutzpah to telephone Ms Gillard on Budget Day to complain that the relationship between the parties was too one-sided. The Greens are now on a mission to improve the budget in the Parliament. The main issues at stake, the price on carbon, along with the income cut-off level for carbon tax compensation, both issues giving the Greens the opportunity to press their redistributive agenda. Ominously, on June the 29th, Senator Brown intends to outline the Greens' balance of power agenda at the National Press Club. According to Brown, the Greens will deliver stability in government while backing, and I quote, a whole range of issues that might be on the agenda now that otherwise would have been buried. So, post 1 July, we can expect plenty of Greens exhumations in the Senate. Bob Brown, who has spent his life lying in front of bulldozers, will now be able to drive one through the Australian economy. This is what the Greens' carbon and mining tax policies will do. Meanwhile, Senator Milne gives every indication she would go even further. Policies the Greens will push include higher punitive mining taxes, bringing in death taxes and expanding the capital gains tax, increasingly progressive personal taxes, cutting funding to independent schools, increasing company taxes and introducing ecological taxes, a complete ban on all live exports, pulling Australia out of ANZUS, establishing tough restrictions in vast new marine parks. And let me turn to my portfolio area, workplace relations. Recently, Adam Bant noted that the Greens' view on employment and industrial relations would receive, quote, greater prominence after 1 July. The Greens have already led the charge to abolish the Australian Building and Construction Commission, which sought to restore the rule of law in the construction industry. Apart from that, Jim, the Greens' workplace relations settings include a 35-hour working week, a mandatory minimum of 5 weeks paid annual leave for all employees, green bargaining between workers and employers, enshrining union rights to prosecute employers in national occupational health and safety law, repealing the secondary boycott provisions, protecting unions and workers from common law actions, abolishing the requirement for secret ballots, introducing national industrial manslaughter laws, and allowing casual workers the right to challenge their termination. In recent years, unions like the CFMEU, ETU and AMWU have given the Greens over $600,000 worth in donations. Usually, this money would have been destined for Labor's coffers, this in itself provides another front for disharmony between the Alliance partners. As a Tasmanian, I trust you will forgive me for harking back to Tasmania's Labor-Green Accord. After the 1989 general election, Liberal Premier Robin Gray had 17 seats, Michael Field's Labor had 13, the Greens 5, giving them the balance of power. Two of these five Greens were Bob Brown, their unofficial leader, and Christine Milne. But when State Cabinet announced its adoption of the Federal Government's Forest Industry Strategy in 1990, the Greens terminated the accord. It had lasted 409 days. The memory of this instability still casts a shadow over Tasmania and its capacity to attract much-needed investment. Mr. Field later compared the relationship between Labor and the Greens to a forced marriage which ended in a very acrimonious divorce. The similarities between the Labor-Green Accord in Tasmania 20 years ago and the current Greens-Labor Alliance should not go unnoted, especially given the presence of Senators Brown and Milne. Under the present agreement, in return for support, Labor has given the Greens a commitment to a carbon tax, a pipeline into government policy formulation, and the prospect of achieving advantage through electoral reform. And while the agreement states as a goal that the parties will work together to, quote, agree that this Parliament should serve its full term, at the same time it states that the parties agree to work to pursue policies which promote the national interest and allows the Greens to move no confidence motions. While Labor may, from time to time, be humiliated by the Greens and Liberals siding together, as recently happened to establish an inquiry into detention policy and to condemn Labor's Malaysian solution, what will occur if the coalition sides with Labor against the Greens on an issue the Greens consider is in the national interest? Earlier this year, Senator Brown was piqued when Labor and the Coalition wrote to the President of the Senate to harmlessly recall the Senate an hour or so earlier than scheduled, simply to mark the Christchurch earthquake at the same time as in New Zealand. Even though efforts had been made to contact Senator Brown, it was not good enough. Now, this behaviour must be worrying for Labor. What would the Greens do if Labor and the Coalition voted in the Senate to thwart something the Greens really wanted? Already the Labor right has split on a Senate report on the Territory's legislation, which would have advanced the Green social agenda on gay marriage and euthanasia, and there are similar strains within the Labor left on its Malaysian solution. All this suggests there could be plenty of brinkmanship in the Senate post 1 July. Despite Senator Brown telling Australians they won't have an early election, it should not be forgotten that Senators Brown and Milne have already brought down one government. Already strains between the parties are showing. The Greens have moved the first motion to condemn the government's Malaysian solution. It's not a huge step in political terms to see the Greens deeming the Malaysian solution counter to the national interest, a key principle of the Greens-Labor agreement. Now let's remember that the Greens rejected the government's carbon pollution reduction scheme in 2009. Why? Because it didn't go far enough. So it is even possible the carbon tax could still prompt such a move. Policy differences will, without doubt, deliver government stagnation. Now, while Labor is tearing itself in two on the policy front, internal stability is also faltering with open talk about another coup. But internal stability is also a problem for the Greens. Despite claiming he would be around for decades, Senator Brown has said he hopes there will be a bit of jostling for the leadership when his parliamentary numbers increase in July, thereby making a virtue of the unavoidable. Senator Brown will turn 67 this year. Although he's not too old to be leader, the drums are beating, it's time to go. Simultaneously, the switch to Canberra by Lee Rhiannon, who herself turned 60 this year, has led to speculation of a confrontation. My colleague, Senator Michael Ronaldson, has noted that Rhiannon wants the leadership and no one will stop the Lee for leader train. Brown's putative successor is Senator Milne, but the four incoming senators appear to owe no allegiance to her. Indeed, last September, Senator Hanson Young challenged Milne for the deputy's position. Lee Rhiannon is, as I've said before, the embodiment of the old guard lefty green that Senator Brown has sought to harness and hide at the same time. It's not hard to envisage a scenario where the left-wing senators might test Senators Brown or Milne, if not both. Small party dynamics in the Senate are volatile. The Democrats imploded amidst infighting between the young and the old, the party room and the party organisation, and over the party's direction, centrist or leftist, the very same factors latent in the new Greens party room. These internal divisions, evident in the Greens party room, do not suggest political stability for our country. A very obvious fault line in the Greens party room will be the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign against Israel, the BDS. This policy dogged the Greens during the New South Wales campaign. Rhiannon's reaction was to simply argue that more time should have been spent building support for BDS. For this, she was publicly slapped down the same day by Senator Brown. Then on the 4th of April, Senator Brown emphatically told Lakeline that the New South Wales Green support for BDS had been rejected by the Australian Greens National Council in 2010 and said that he also rejected this policy. 10 days later, Rhiannon told Sky's The Nation program that she continued to support the BDS against Israel, saying, quote, "We have that position in New South Wales, and I support the New South Wales position, but it's not something we're taking to the federal parliament." 2 days later, at a meeting at the ANU staged by the Green Institute, Senator Brown argued passionately for a move from a federalist to a national party structure, the spur being the New South Wales branch's BDS policy. According to one source quoted by the Canberra Times, mismanagement of the Israel boycott issue had spooked some inside the Greens because it made the party look like a bunch of radicals who were happy to fight with each other. Bob is genuinely concerned about Lee Rhiannon going into the Senate. He doesn't want to see everything he's worked for collapse, and he knows there is one or two of his federal team that could be vulnerable to people like Lee. Now, in a hitherto unnoticed blog on the 16th of May titled Greens New South Wales and the Campaign for Palestinian Rights, Lee Rhiannon has delivered her riposte. She noted remarks by Bob Brown about tolerating diverse opinions and then pointedly stated that, as a confederation of parties that make up the Australian Greens, sometimes our work on national policies will vary. She then threw down the gauntlet to Brown, saying, "It is not accurate to say that the Greens National Council rejected a BDS proposal. The Australian Greens did not reject BDS. There was no vote to reject it. A less stringent boycott was supported. While the Greens New South Wales support for BDS is an expansion of the Australian Greens position, it does not contravene the national position." She goes on to say, "Despite the intimidation, misinformation and abuse in recent months directed towards the Greens New South Wales, I will not step away from speaking out for Palestinian human rights." Note this, supporting human rights for Palestinians will be part of my work as a senator. Now, this is not Bob Brown's so-called hate media inventing this. It's from his very own new colleague. The above clearly shows there is a power struggle between Rhiannon and Brown. Senator-elect Rhiannon has nailed her colours to the mast, and she would likely be backed by Senators Hanson, Young and Ludlam in her anti-Israel efforts. I should observe that BDS is also splitting the Labor Party, with Mr Rudd unable to back coalition motions condemning this anti-Israel campaign, something which would never have happened under Bob Hawke. Now, with their rise in influence, the Greens are now finally attracting critical attention. Nationally, the public is rejecting the Greens' prescriptions for climate change and wising up to how Greens' policies have driven up their water and power bills. To quote Paul Kelly, "The Green agenda has corrupted Labor values. It has seen Labor governments embrace fiscal irresponsibility, regressive income redistribution, and treat their supporters as too dumb to understand they were being played for mugs. For too long, the idea that any Green scheme was a good scheme was sanctified as a compliant media cheered such initiatives. Climate change, once Labor's dream issue, has become the nightmare issue on which Labor has wedged itself. These issues and the political environment is allowing for a more robust approach to the Greens." The ACT, which recorded the lowest swing to the Greens in 2010, saw the Liberals run an aggressive anti-Greens campaign, targeting Greens policies on independent schools. The Greens buckled, inventing new policy and contradicting themselves. Since then, we've seen in Victoria and New South Wales that the Greens haven't performed as well as expected. In both instances, cases of hypocrisy by the Greens candidates has been exposed, but even more importantly, Greens policies have been exposed. In Victoria, it was the Greens' policies on private health insurance and death taxes. In New South Wales, it was the BDS campaign. In Victoria, the Greens' last preference strategy was very successful, more so, if I might say, than the New South Wales open ticket strategy. It seems the public are beginning to focus on what the Greens really stand for. As a result, their relentless march has been slowed. Now, as far as the Parliament is concerned, Labor will not be able to rely on the Coalition to protect them. The suggestion that the Coalition should support legislation we oppose to stop even worse legislation that the Greens might demand is to misunderstand our principles and our resolve. We will, for example, neither support Labor's attempt to neuter the Australian Building and Construction Commission nor the Greens' attempt to abolish it. Labor will be judged and held accountable each time they break an election promise or introduce bad legislation. The new paradigm excuse simply won't wash. Labor willingly signed up with the Greens in a grab for power and can't expect the Coalition to protect them from their own alliance partner. So one scenario may be that Labor hardheads will call for an early election so as to stem the damage being caused to their base by their alliance with the Greens. I somehow think Labor might wish that it had lost the 2007 election in this state rather than the 2011 election. So the Labor hardheads might just think it's better to lose now than be completely wiped out in 2 years' time. Given all the factors at play, the instability, the uncertainty, the policy stagnation and extremism, is it too much to ask for the Coalition and Labor at the next federal election, in the national interest, to put the Greens last on their how to vote papers? But in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, please fasten your seat belts as we are about to head into some political turbulence. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Senator Betts. I should also thank Mallesons for the use of this facility. It wasn't so long ago we had Julie Gillard at this podium last year, and it's great to have Senator Betts. I can't remember where we had Bob Brown, but it wasn't here, I think. So we've got about 20 minutes, no more then, so we'll be quick with our questions and comments and responses. Your conclusion was interesting. You're also aware, of the two Greens you specifically criticised for being on the left, Adam Bandt and Lee Rhiannon. As you know, Adam Bandt was elected on Liberal Party preferences, and Lee Rhiannon may have been elected on Liberal Party preferences.
Yeah.
That's an opportunity, isn't it, for the Liberal Party to seem more positive to Labour whilst getting rid of people you regard as a greater problem than Labour. It seemed to me, from what you're saying tonight, you're sympathetic to putting the Greens behind Labour in the allocation of preferences, but what sort of support has that got within the leadership group in Canberra?
I won't talk about the leadership group in Canberra. Ultimately, it is a decision for the organisation. At the last federal election, we in Tasmania made what we believe was the principal decision to put the Greens last. It would be fair to say that we were the odd one out. Having seen how well the aggressive ACT campaign was, where Senator Gary Humphries was fighting for his political life, not against Labor, but against the Greens, the Liberal Party, if I can use the sexist term, manned up, fought the Greens, exposed the Greens, and as a result, kept the Greens to a very low swing. I think that those two steps gave the Victorians heart to say to the Victorian people, and keep this in mind, before the Victorian Liberals came out, Ted Baillieu was not going to win. But he then said, we won't preference the Greens, we won't do a deal with the Greens because of their policies, and then attack them. That left Labor in a position where a lot of Conservative Labor voters asked the simple question, Mr. Brumby, why are you preferencing the Greens? Why aren't you ruling out a deal with the Greens, given their policies are so extreme? And in that last 10-14 days, a lot of Conservative Labor voters switched to us. And I think there is a message in that for us to gain more Conservative Labor voters, to get back the Howard Battlers, if I can use that term, I think we should highlight the fact that Greens and Labor together will be pursuing policies that don't sit comfortably with the Conservative Labor voter. Having said that, Jared, I personally, knowing Senator Steve Hutchins from New South Wales, scratch my head and do think, how is it that the Liberal Party assisted a generally Conservative Labor senator out of the Senate in favour of Lee Rhiannon? I confess I don't get it. I confess in the past I've been a minority within my party on these issues. I hope that the events, especially in Victoria, will give courage for us to take a more principled stand.
Next question here, and go there. Yep.
Senator, do you think that the situation with the Greens has educated the public a lot more about preferences and how they work? Because I get a sense that a lot of people felt cheated by the outcome of the last election.
Can I just repeat that for us? The question is whether the...
Whether people understand the importance of preferences basically in delivering the outcomes. And if I might be as bold as to... Thank you. If I might be as bold as to say that in Melbourne Ports, for example, it was Liberal preferences that delivered the seat to the Greens. In the seat of O'Connor, it was Labor preferences that delivered a Liberal seat to the National Party. Now, can I say, if both parties were honest with their supporters, I don't think their supporters would be that chuffed, if I can use that technical term, about supporting a National over a Liberal, or us supporting a Green over Labor. In the Senate itself, of course, we have now had Family First lose its seat and the DLP resurrected from nowhere after an absence of 36 years. Preferences are important, they do count, and I for one can say that I would sleep a lot easier if Steve Hutchins was still in the Senate as opposed to Lee Rhiannon, and preferences made the difference.
You referred there to Melbourne Ports. I think you referred to
Melbourne,
to
sorry.
The seat of Melbourne, yeah.
Thank you over for here, that correction.
Eric, given the
Could
Greens...
Could you just speak up? We're trying to get this on, caught by these microphones.
Oh, okay. Given the Greens' treatment of the CPRS a couple of years ago, what do you think they'd do in the Senate if they fronted legislation with a carbon tax price of $20 per tonne as per the Treasury modelling today?
That is one of the big issues that I think the Greens will need to answer. I don't have an answer for you tonight, but in relation to compensation and all those other matters, one of the big things that Senator Brown was against the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme was the compensation for, quote-unquote, the big polluters. Allegedly, a Greg Combe tells me that, and the Australian people, they'll still be getting some compensation. And just whilst I am on compensation, nobody still seems to have figured out that the cost of implementing this scheme is going to cost a fair number of percentage points of the total amount of money gathered. We're being told so much percentage goes here, so much percentage there, but they never talk about the cost of administering the scheme, and I would imagine it would be at least 5 or 10%, so somebody's going to miss out there.
There and here, yep.
I'm just trying to work out where it's all going to end up with the kind of numbers in the Senate. If Labor puts up a scheme that the Greens don't find suitable, and the Coalition is against it full stop, how long are we waiting for the Senate to pass a carbon tax? Well, I mean, this could go on for some time. Could you give us a little breakdown of how the scenarios might fall?
Once I set the topic for tonight, I realised I'd sort of tried to set myself a crystal ball, and it is very difficult to consider all the permutations of what might happen. But if the Labor Party comes up with a proposal that doesn't have the sign-off of the so-called cross-party committee, and the Greens don't fully support it and say, well, we're in fact going to vote against it, there'll be a majority in the Senate against the carbon tax. Now, it would be a bizarre thing, would it not, if Ms Gillard then went to the Australian people saying, I want a mandate for my broken election promise. Stranger things I'm sure have happened and will happen in politics, but I would think that the carbon tax is so fundamental to the Labor-Green alliance that they will nut something out, but I fear more to the Green side of the equation than the Labor side. That, I think, might agitate certain people like Martin Ferguson in the Labor Party and cause greater rifts within Labor. But all the permutations, there's a lot of instability within Labor, within the Greens, and then between Labor and the Greens as well, which makes for a cocktail of huge uncertainty, and that, I think, is going to be a real problem for just the sense of economic security in Australia. People are already stopping spending, they're saving, they're uncertain, and I think that is part and parcel of the political environment we're in.
Here,
then
we go to
yep. Aren't the people in Tasmania happy with the Green-Labor compromise that was given to them then by the government?
Straight after the event, they were, and if I might say, it wasn't given to them by the governor. The governor, in fairness, made the right decision on the advice that he was given. Might I say the advice he was given by the then Labor Premier was substantially different to that which the Labor Premier promised the Tasmanian people. But the governor had to act on the advice he was given as opposed to election promises. But look, having said that, the latest polls in Tasmania would indicate if an election were to have been held at the last weekend, Will Hodgman would be the Premier of a majority Liberal government.
Lindsay, yeah.
As you indicated, the opposition, the V Liberal National Party and the Greens from time to time might want to agree. Do you currently have, and will you have, a formal means of dialogue or communication between your position as Leader of the Opposition and the Leader of the Greens?
Look, unlike Labor that have the Monday morning meeting with the Prime Minister, we won't have any formal means, but it is on an ad hoc basis. And if I might say, when we dealt with a piece of legislation some time back, it was a bizarre situation, but Senator Seward from the Greens, Senator Xenophon and myself, we sat in my office, we worked out all the amendments we wanted. We said, no, we won't support the Greens on that, but the Greens would support us on one of our amendments we support. And if I might say, we had a professional, good working relationship, but on an ad hoc basis, depending on what the issue is. But on a permanent basis that we meet regularly for a cup of coffee, whether we have something to talk about or not, no, that's not exactly on the agenda at the moment.
Frank or Philip?
Yeah, from the way you've portrayed the Greens, which I actually think is a very insightful way of looking at the Greens, would you agree that what we're dealing with now is as much an issue about the values of Australians and our community as about politics? I don't see any politics in this at all. I see it as values. If you get too far to one end of the spectrum, it becomes a values issue. And we're really talking about a wolf in sheep's clothing here because they've been very successful at infiltrating.
The suggestion here that what's at stake is not so much an issue of politics, but rather an issue of values.
Mm. Well, to use the Australian analogy, rather than a wolf in sheep's clothing, it's the koala bear suit covering a social agenda, which I think most Australians don't actually agree with. And so are we talking about some very important values? From my perspective, yes, we are. Do we support private enterprise? Do we support the market economy? Do we support the family unit? Do we support marriage? And the list goes on and on. And the Greens seem to be fundamentally opposed to nearly every one of those issues that I have mentioned. So, it is a battle for the values, and that is why with the Territories Bill, which was a Greens bill to basically give the territories the right to legislate on gay unions and euthanasia, two right-wing Labor senators, for the first time in a very, very long time, wrote a dissenting report. And clearly, the conservative right-wing Labor heartland is hemorrhaging away from the Labor Party towards us, because we actually support a lot of the values that they uphold. Because a lot of them, in fact, are aspirational. You know, they do want private health insurance. They do want to send their kids to an independent school because it's the biggest investment they'll ever be able to make for their kids. And so a bit of government support is something that they actually like because it allows them to live out their aspirations. And so I think that is where Labor has wedged itself very badly.
Now we're getting towards the end, so I think we'll...
All right, I'll be... No, it's not you. Quicker.
No, you're
all
fine.
Right. Oh, thank you.
There's a question here and the final question up the back.
All right.
Yep.
Yes. How are you going with the doctor's wives? They were said to be truly liberal voters who thought the Greens were going to help with the garden.
That's a very nice way of putting it. For those that didn't hear it, that the doctor's wives were liberal voters who supported the Greens because that it helped them with their garden. Now, I think when you start advising them of their stance on private health insurance, on their basic desire to nationalise health, on private school funding, on death taxes, some of these things start hitting very close to home. And the difficulty is that, if I might say, in a rare moment of reflection and commentary, my own party and others have been sending out a mixed message to the Australian people. Now, we sort of condemn the Greens, but then we sort of want their preferences as well. We've been sending out mixed messages rather than saying look, we don't support the Greens, we won't preference the Greens, and here are the reasons why. And Victoria did that exceptionally well. I think in New South Wales, not preference or not allocating preferences at all was good. The ACT Senate campaign in 2010 was also a good example of that. So we'll have to keep educating.
Final question up the back. Yep.
This is not the first time we've had a minority government in the Senate. Would you like to draw some parallels with the Libs in, what was it, 61, with needing the DLP support, and then subsequently various parties needing the Democrats' support, Labor and then Liberal?
If I might say, the DLP were more a, what, Democrat-type party from the right, whereas the Democrats were sort of like a DLP party from the left, and so you could actually sit down with most of them and talk, and they still held values that were relatively within the mainstream. And in running the parliament, not that I can comment on the DLP days, I haven't been there that long, but in relation to the Democrats, you could talk with them, and there was a sense of the realpolitik about them. So you could negotiate with them on workplace relations, you could negotiate with them on the GST, whereas the Greens have a fundamentalism, a dogmatism about them, and a sense of the end justifies the means, a sense of moral superiority that they are the holders of and nobody else shares with them, that I think makes for a lot more difficult circumstance for the Labor Party to deal with.
Senator Betts, many thanks.
Thank you, and once again, my apologies.
Well, the Senator was late getting here, but it was worth waiting for. So thanks for a very strong address, an unequivocal address. It's very clear where you're coming from, but also a talk that, and also in question and discussion time, that you supplemented with empirical evidence and facts, which are always very important. So we're pleased you could make it tonight. After the 1st of July, of course, as Leader of the Opposition in the Senate, you're going to have to play a crucial role, because if you support the government, that legislation gets through, and if you don't, then the Greens come into play. So we're very glad that shortly before the 1st of July, you're at the Sydney Institute, talking about how you see the Greens and Australian politics. And I'm sure we'll have you back in, again, once again in the future. But tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.